the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard up in the city of Shasta Lake. And they've got everything you need when it comes to John Deere. Go up and see them. They're also the new Ego dealer. They have a full line of residential and commercial Ego products in stock. They've got the zero-turn Ego electric mowers, electric riders. They've got all the handheld stuff. So go up and see them. They've got good pricing and good inventory right now. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is area code 530-226-9226. Or you can go to the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
How do you spell that?
That's P-A-P-E.
Right on.
Or Peppy.
The old Pape Machinery up on Twin View. So we have Nathan on there. Got Nathan. Hold on. We don't have my computer, though, so I can't tell you about Nathan.
Now I think without your computer?
That's pretty much it, too. Oh, my gosh. Here we go. Nathan and his family raise registered feeder cats in central Montana. How fun is that? Home on the Range. Yeah. I'm probably going to have to play that today. He is a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures. And I have to tell you, if you live in rural America and you're not an expert on those things, you get to go to a lot of meetings and hope there's somebody like Nathan at your meeting. He specializes in land and natural resource policymaking, local government relations, and program management. He's also an accomplished musician and a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. Nathan has worked with local governments to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations that are facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. So Nathan Deshmaker he gave us a couple articles for today. One is called Climate Control Policies Will Fail the Farm. And the other one is CO2 Should Be Celebrated, Not Captured, which is kind of funny. Both of those are files you can download. They're on the page for today, which is February 18th, 2024. And we will be having a non-dramatic show today, just like a little side announcement there. And if you missed the drama of last week with our guest Aaron Friday, where we discussed the California initiative to give parents back their rights and stop the transgender ideology from taking over, you can go and check that out, the sound file of the giant rock coming through the window and pictures and all that. That was on last week. What was that, the 11th? Yep, the 11th, February the 11th, 2024, so all the drama is there. This week, we're just going to talk about the evil federal government.
Yeah, just that.
We've moved on. We've moved on
only
to the evil,
the evil government.
Just the evil federal government. So I deal a lot with the evil federal government. Nathan, how's it working out for you guys in Montana these days?
Well, we're staying busy, that's for sure, on just... just life and in general, obviously. But yeah, a lot going on.
Yeah, they've got bad plans. Every time you turn around, more bad plans.
Yeah, for sure. There's every time you come to an end of year and you come into the holiday season, that's a prime time for federal agencies to drop some rules on the Federal Register, and that's. They did that through the Forest Service on a couple items, and so that's so some of my focus recently has been on some Forest Service items and what they're doing there. We can discuss a little bit of that today probably, and but I just want to say too, appreciate you guys having me on. I was hoping to have another individual with me that's very brilliant in relationship to the property clause and Article 1 and so maybe on a future call, maybe that can be set up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I get it. Sometimes you try to get two people who have the same, you know, to get the same schedule and get it all together, and that doesn't always work. That is absolutely something. We're going to talk about this stuff pretty much forever. I mean, this is like year number 14. Kind of did this as a lark 14 years ago. Thought, oh, yeah, never done it before. Okay, it'd be kind of fun. And then here we are. Yikes. Yikes. Now we're in. Now, let's see. Now we're old enough to be in the Social Security zone. we grew old talking crap about the government on the radio. It's got to be a country song about that somewhere. Oh man. So where would you like to start today? There was a lot of material. I really liked both of the articles that you gave us. I don't know if you want to discuss those specifically, but they were both really quite good.
Yeah, I think so. I'll touch on those. I guess I sent over kind of a title of where we are,
yep,
where we came from, and where we're going. So yeah, I think we can start with where we are. Those documents you posted are both recent, pretty fresh off the press. One of them was actually out of the Buckeye Institute. Their economic department are the ones that... And I had it pulled up in front of me, and I'm not seeing it. But anyways, that one, they did a simulation of a small corn farm and applied the net zero policies in finding economic impacts of applying many of the things that are trying to be pushed through, and showed a 34% increase in operating costs just based on the carbon pricing framework that's being proposed out there. And then obviously there was a significant percentage of increase of cost to the consumer,
of course,
on the other end of that. So it was good to see the Buckeye Institute putting that out, though, because otherwise it's just one hand clapping out there on all this net zero and climate policy. And then alongside that, the 12 state agricultural commissioners at the state levels also issued a letter January 29th of this year regarding an impact of Net Zero Banking Alliance on agriculture and food security. And since that letter was issued, some of those banks have actually withdrawn from that alliance. So that's some good news that there's some pushback and pressure coming from some of our states and other some academic institutions that are finally putting out some good economic stuff on these items. And then the other thing, just to quickly mention, is the natural asset company rule that was submitted by the New York Stock Exchange to the Security and Exchange Commission after 24, or not, well, maybe it was 24, I can't remember, maybe 12, I can't remember how many, but Kansas and Utah AG's offices led the way, and then, you know, American Stewards of Liberty, Margaret Byfield, and then a lot of other people really pushed back on that rule, and that also was later withdrawn by the New York Stock Exchange. So there's been some good news in that front of some pushback and some of these agencies stepping back on a couple of these items. So finally nice to see some of that at least.
Well, let's not forget, too, the private industry backing away from a lot of this craziness, too. I mean, a lot of this DEI stuff they put out there, BlackRock and some of these other ones are saying, you know what, enough's enough. This is just not working. And they wouldn't do that unless there was, like, a major negative impact on their business. I mean, a lot of the decisions they make, we all know, have some sort of a negative impact. It's probably not big enough to worry about. But for them to back out of a lot of these things are a clear indicator that it's just not working. And people are getting fed up with it.
Well, it's expensive.
It is.
And the idea that... Yeah, the benefits are unclear too.
Well,
you know, the idea that it's going to solve all these problems, and it's like,
it always seems like the consumer cost of a lot of this stuff is always way down on the list of talking points. You know, they talk about all the phony good stuff that's going to happen, but you know, they never mention the increased cost to the consumer for most of these programs, and I think that's that's part of the big impact with inflation is are these a lot of these policies.
Yeah, I would agree. That's the relief with the Buckeye Institute is they took that into consideration. And the problem with federal regulations and rules that regulate our industries or our natural resource industries in particular, the rules are always finalized. The regulatory framework is finalized and basically set in stone well in advance, usually before the consumers actually see the inflationary impact of that regulation coming out of their own personal wallets. So that's, and agencies are supposed to, under existing congressional law, to project, you know, in a reasonable fashion, the cost benefit, you know, through a cost benefit analysis or whatever else, right, to project what are those impacts going to be on those consumers. And, you know, what I'm finding is the social justice and environmental justice stuff is being so entrenched in agency priorities currently that, you know, like they're doing, EPA is rewriting, doing regulatory changes for the meat and poultry processing facilities to regulate indirect discharges. And in the Federal Register notice for that rule, they cite, you know, there's like total aggregate of $200 million of annual costs. And then they tout 94 some odd million dollars of monetized benefits, but the monetized benefits are coming from carbon sequestration, ecosystem services, environmental justice. So where are they getting that $95 million value from? They're arbitrarily placing a dollar figure on something that's not tangible,
right,
and currently being traded on the market. But instead of them being like, how, instead of them focusing on how's this going to affect the currently non-regulated processing facilities that are owned by individuals out there and the counties and states that have them, they're more worried about putting a arbitrary dollar figure on environmental justice, ecosystem services, and social things that, and those things can never be accurately determined except for on a case by case basis. And so that's what's happening, though. It's the focal point of the agencies at this point is very misdirected.
Well, they're not.
And they're being called out, but yeah,
they're not even living up to their own mission. I mean, at the risk of, you know, causing me to fly into a rage, the Klamath Dam scam, where they're you know, removing four dams under the guise of creating 400 miles of habitat. Well, it's like, I don't know, 30 miles of river or something. 400 mile. The 400 mile number comes from every drop of water between here and the lower part of Oregon. Oh, that's part of the 400 miles. So it's not the public would think that was 400 miles here to somewhere. That isn't 400 miles. And you look at the regulatory stuff. That's all been done through regulatory process. None of it was done by congressional action. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said, well, I guess you can do it, and California can regulate. Since they have their own EPA, they can regulate the Clean Water Act aspect of it. But are you kidding me? They've killed everything in the river. I mean, you get dead fish everywhere. Yeah. These are the same fish the farmers were being fined for just months ago. You can't, you know, these are endangered species they're wiping out. And they sat right there in a meeting I went to last week and said, well, you know, we anticipated all this. This is all to be expected. I mean, they're supposed to be about fish and wildlife now. California changed their name. So they're all about fish and wildlife. Well, I'm sorry, but the deer are getting stuck in the mud and either dying from just struggle or having to be shot. You've got beavers and fish and crawdads and the whole host of things that live in the river can't live in it because it's black. But that's okay.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We can do that now. And so they asked, like, what about the tributaries? What about that, where they've got all these projects, and, oh, my God, you probably have it in Montana, too, with all the fish screens and all this drama to make more fish? All those fish are going to go to the river?
Yeah.
Boom, dead.
Oh yeah, but they said that they won't actually go to the river now. They'll stay in the tributary.
They're going to stay in the tributary because they all have email, I guess, and they found out that the river is black. I don't know how that works. I mean, you have people who think that fish and game can,
fish and wildlife.
They're fish and game because it goes with fun and games. You know what I mean? Fish and wildlife doesn't say fun and games, so it's not fun for me. People think, they should have people along the side of the river to keep the animals from getting stuck in the mud. Like, it's 200 miles. Like 200 miles.
Yeah.
Well, they have a lot of people. Really? So the general public, even the people who might be on our team really kind of need to get a grip a little bit. I don't think people realize what's going on in rural America, honestly. But see, at the risk of being on a tirade, and then I was on a tirade, we have to take a really quick break. Sorry. Well, not sorry. Sorry, not sorry. And then we'll come back with our guest.
Excuse me.
We're not coming back for a break.
For some reason, I thought it was 30 because I wasn't thinking. So take a little time while I get this song up.
This is how things went haywire last week. It was we're taking a break, we're not taking a break, and then kabam. Although last week did have a great song. It's worth listening to the clip just to hear the song that was queued up ahead of time. Did a bad, bad thing. That's a fun song. But we'll be back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker, up there in Montana, in the great state. Maybe. Maybe not. What's happening in there? How are we doing? We're doing good? No pressure? I'm the Jeopardy song for him.
I found it.
Okay. You're listening to We the People yet again with more live radio buffoonery right here on KCNR.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stay.
See a hat trick?
We're back.
What?
Very few ads.
What? Got very quiet. All right, Nathan. Now that I've been ranting and raving about the Klamath, which probably will happen again, just, you know, spoiler alert, it's probably going to happen again.
Yeah.
But honestly, I mean, every single thing that they are regulating, like now California gets to do its own clean water permit. Well, I'm sorry, but you couldn't put 50 million cubic yards of sediment in a river, ever, anywhere, and kill endangered species.
And get a permit.
And get a permit.
That's okay.
So now that they're the licensee on the project, then they're underwriting it, now they can do whatever they want because they write their... I mean, it's like the, you know, that whole thing about the fox in the hen house, it's like almost sort of trite. I mean...
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing in Montana with the solar. They just put out a plan for the utility solar development on BLM lands in the Northwest. And, yeah, if it's putting up solar panels they're just fine with streamlining everything. And meanwhile, a rancher, in some cases, depending on the field office you're in and the BLM in the region, can't even get through the process to put in a water development, which is in law called a rangeland improvement. You know, you can't even accomplish those things, but they're opening up 22 million acres so that they can install solar, utility-scale solar farms on BLM-administered lands. And so they're opening up 22 million acres, but the plan only calls for 700,000 acres, I think, is what they want to get to. But they're opening up 22 million acres, so they have maximum flexibility.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I want maximum flexibility. That's it. I want to, the speed limit is anywhere from 50 to 90 so that I can have maximum flexibility. Because, you know, that works everywhere. That's how all the regulations are written. Maximum flexibility.
So when we talk about rules, new rules, maybe you could tell me what's the difference between a rule and the law? Because we have laws covering much of this already, but now we have new rules to support the laws,
right? Or make,
it's like they're new laws.
This is right up Nathan's alley.
Yeah, so, and that's a really good question, and it's, there's some simple answers to it, but there's some broader issues that get discussed in that discussion. But a rule, agencies that promulgate rules, you know, policy manuals, guidance documents, things like that, mm-hmm. don't have any real teeth in them and are, don't have the force of law at the end of the day. But an agency that amends, say, a resource management plan under the Federal Land Policy Management Act and goes through the full NEPA process in doing that, and that sets the policy for how the lands are managed and et cetera. And when that goes through what's called a record of decision through the full process, public process and whatnot, that rule then becomes, in a certain sense, it's not law in the context of, it didn't come directly from the Congress, obviously, the sole lawmaking right. power under the Constitution.
As it should
but
be.
It does, but the Congress has allowed in some of the, that's, some of the problem that we ultimately face in the administrative state and bureaucracy on the federal front is probably Congress delegating, entering into a non-delegation realm in passing certain rulemaking powers and regulatory functions over to the executive branch. And
yep.
So it's not a simple answer to the question because it's kind of a convoluted mess on the way it's all functioning. But what I will say, records of decisions through the land use planning processes have some level of binding authority on those lands. And that's what the Biden administration is doing with these forest plans and everything that's moving right now. Their goal is to get records of decisions on all these things that are moving. The utility scale solar, all that's in process. Those aren't final rules yet. They're going through the process in analyzing and setting alternatives and putting it out for public comment. And then after it goes through that whole process, then there's usually a protest period when they issue a final draft of the document and what the rule does. And then it becomes a final rule with a record of decision. And that's what they wanted. That's what this administration is really pushing to do with the Forest Service amendments, the sage-grouse amendments. And there's 98 resource management plans for the sage-grouse opened up right now. And before Christmas last year, the Forest Service opened up 128 Forest Service unit plans, which is all of them virtually, for managing for old growth and carbon sequestration. But what that does is it opens up all those management plans so that now the agencies can take these policies, which are not binding, mm-hmm. infuse them into the amendment process. You know, there's bad policy that agencies have been promulgating for the last 3 years in manuals and directives. So what's happening now is they really want to get those things weaved into the resource management plans and get a record of decision on that. Because right now, indigenous knowledge is not a baseline for decision making through a lot of this process. And that's one thing they're pushing so they can get in those amendments on the land planning front. And what that will do is make it, if we have an incumbent administration in the federal presidency that's the other side of this, it's easy to undo policy. It's not easy to undo final amendments and rules
right.
that these agencies are promulgating.
And as far as enforcement of those rules, when push comes to shove, can they actually prosecute somebody for breaking a rule?
All day.
There's penalties attached on certain things, yeah. I mean, if you violate, it's enforceable under land management planning stuff. I mean, there's been people in Utah, even in Montana in the past, that have been raided for taking what they consider artifacts off of BLM and have been administered lands. So there's very definitely an enforcement arm that's been used when you are accused or do or violate some of those provisions. That and where that comes from is in these rules.
But don't they ultimately have to be tied to a law?
Are they technically?
Well, so that's so there's where the issue really is. So what's happening? Congress has set priorities for the Forest Service, for example. The congressional statutes delegate powers to the executive branch and the administration and the USDA Forest Service. And there's under congressional law, those lands are supposed to be inventoried and monitored in a way to facilitate mature growth and a reasonable flow and receipt of timber for the benefit of local communities, local economies. That's in statute.
Right.
And it's tied into the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. And multiple use and sustained yield are obvious terms, multiple use and sustained yield. And as you guys know, the forest wood products industry in much of the federal lands in the Northwest, because of the spotted owl and other things, has already been almost entirely hamstrung. And now they want to reserve all these old growth forests and make them off limits from any timber harvesting through these 128 plan amendments. And they're doing it not based, see, that's the thing, is they're not following the congressional priorities here. Congress, I haven't seen yet in my review of the statutes anywhere that old growth is ever mentioned and prioritized by the Congress to Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service to prioritize old growth forests for carbon sequestration. It's not in statute. So they're doing wholesale changes across the forest reserves through these amendments based on priorities that are not coming from the Congress, but are coming from, it's coming out of Executive Order 14072, the Biden executive order that started the process to have Forest Service start to focus on carbon sequestration and preserving and reserving old growth forests. So that executive order led to an assessment that was developed by the Forest Service, an inventory of old growth forests. But there's no statute that directs the agency to inventory for that priority.
Imagine that.
But that's what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah. And that, well, you have a bunch of things that are happening. So while they're doing that, we're not managing timber. I mean, out here,
exactly.
Where we are, we're not managing for maintenance. So maybe the whole thing doesn't burn down, which I think is amazing. So as all of the foresters in the Forest Service have been replaced with ologists of one form or fashion, your actual forestry practices take a backseat or just flat go away.
Well, there's very, very few that are foresters that understand how to manage a healthy forest. I don't think that's one of their priorities.
But if it involves cutting, see, that's not.
Yeah.
Nobody sees that as creating health. On rangeland, cattle out on rangeland is really beneficial if done properly, and yet that's seen as
destroying the
heresy. Got to let everything just sit. But you can put solar panels on it. That's really weird. How many bazillions of acres was that? Is it 20? What'd you say? 20?
Like 22 million acres.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. That's crazy.
And solar panels are, no outcry from the environmentalists.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you increase the heat on the land. So if it's near farmland, messes up the crop production because it changes the temperature. They put them in big enough solar panel blobs. Do they still kill birds because birds think those are lakes and they land on them and burn up? Is that still a thing?
I've heard of that. Yeah, yeah. I've never been around large scale utility solar systems, but they want to push them all over though.
Yeah, from the sky they look like lakes. So the birds come down, sit on them, bzz, burn up because they're really really hot. I mean, but it's kind of like the windmills too. I mean, they chop up all sorts of birds and endangered species and stuff like that. And yet, you know, where exactly are the animal, like up on the Klamath, for instance? It's funny, as we get near a break, suddenly I want to go there. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Where's PETA?
What's wrong with me? But where is PETA? You know, where all these animals are being killed.
Yeah.
Up on the dope grows that we've covered endlessly. They're cooking and eating dogs, for God's sake. You know, where are the animal rights people? I don't understand that. They're busy throwing paint at people who eat chicken in a restaurant, but you know, actual murder of actual animals, you know, that are out there supposed to be protected. I don't know. I think it's kind of making people, all right, I'll be first. It's making people a little crazy. It's making me crazy. Because it doesn't make any sense.
I'll testify to that.
You shut up over there. No ride home for you. That's it. And so maybe we've got to take a break here in a minute or so. So I don't want to cause you to do what I do, which is, you know, fly into a rage and get cut off. But honestly, I think we need to look a little bit in our discussion today on what can people do? Because the bad part is we talk about this and it sort of sounds like the byline is, and by the way, there's nothing you can do. So you might as well just roll over and accept it and don't go to any meetings locally. Don't write letters. Don't. And that's not what we're saying. We're not saying disengage because nothing can be done. And you do.
Yeah.
You work on this all the time. So how about this? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I know we have you as a hostage for the second hour, but let's kind of start to unpack some of the things that people could do, especially if they're not, you know, experts in this field, but they care about it, and especially if they live there. So our guest is Nathan Deshmaker. Should do that again. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome to your life. There's no turning back. Even while we sleep, we will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature.
First class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're called a harvest moon in Kansas. And they'd understand why God made those flyover states.
I always like that song because it's kind of sad, but that is the way it is viewed. You have big populations on the coasts of this country who really don't know a whole lot about what's going on in the middle and truly do not understand the origin of our food. Blows my mind. I got a call not too long ago. A guy was all mad that one of the refuges up north didn't have any water in it. I was like, well, they can't get water in it unless it goes through the farms, because the farmers are the ones that pump the water over into the refuge. So when they cut the water off to the farms, there's no water for the refuge. Well, I don't care about farmers. I just want water in the refuge. Okay, well, it's a plumbing problem. This is basic plumbing. The water comes from the street, goes through the pipes, comes out the faucet. You can't get it out the faucet if it doesn't come from the street. Like, what the heck? But there is a weird... I asked him, too. I go, where do you think your food... Where do you plan to get your food if we cut off all the farmers? They think they're all just somehow making a mint. The farmers and ranchers are just getting fat on the taxpayers' dime, and somehow we need to, I don't know, make it harder for them? Like, yeah, that's possible?
There's a big disconnect. People don't understand the food chain very
You get
well.
That a lot, Nathan? I mean, the policy stuff certainly skews that way. Is Nathan in the cone of silence? Can you, like, unmute Nathan?
What's that?
There we go. Sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. We have to actually push a button here to make it so we can hear you.
Oh.
But I don't. But I'm in a different room, so it's hard for me to do that. I was using my mind, though. I was trying to push a button with my mind. So tons of the policy you deal with just crushes agriculture.
Well, not just agriculture. I mean, the thing is, the free market economy is made up of both efficient and non-efficient functions at every level that contributes to the complex modern industrial systems that we take for granted today that gives pretty ready and affordable access to a lot of material products and goods and services and food, etc. But central planners approach it economic. When they're sitting in their swivel chairs and applying their central economic plans to that market framework, they look at a spreadsheet and say, well, this business and company or industry here is inefficient and these ones are efficient, so we're going to get rid of those and work just with these. But that kind of thinking fails to recognize that it's the independent functions of those other, even the what they would consider an inefficient industry or business, actually makes up a part of the whole framework that contributes to the efficiency of the ones they're looking at as being the most efficient.
Yeah. That's
so
true,
there's,
if the guy,
so there's
if
economic
the guy doesn't make the parts
reasoning
for the,
that... Yeah. Go ahead.
If the guy doesn't make... If nobody makes the parts for the machinery, then the machinery doesn't function. So, yeah, it's all
exactly.
tied together.
Exactly.
Sure.
So when it comes to the agricultural industry, the cattle industry in particular, there's some rules like the meat and poultry processing rule that maybe not initially, but for sure downstream will have impacts. Because when you force a small meat processing facility or feedlot to put in pretreatment systems and new filtration systems and all these different things, that's an increased cost. And it either puts that business out of business, or they either pass those increased costs upstream to the producers, which are the ranchers actually out there raising the cattle, or they pass them downstream to the consumers, or they do both, because those costs are redirected to maintain production. But the way they're coming after the ranching and farming and agriculture and our energy sectors is kind of a somewhat fascist, unholy alliance between international banking finance and government through the executive branch, not only of the United States, but some of our states, as you're talking about with California. California is a part of the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a coalition of state governors that are committed to these international compacts as well. So that's where a lot of those policies are coming from, very much top-down. And the way it gets to the rancher is they use the financial control and leverage to establish ESG-type policies in the finance realm. And then when you're going to get a loan to finance to buy a ranch from your neighbor or whatever, now they set those conditions so they can push people out of finance and having finance options to be able to purchase lands and engage in those industries.
Explain to people what ESG is for the folks that don't know, and spoiler alert, we're doing a show about that with a guy on March 3rd that'll just be about the whole ESG thing. But for people who hear it all the time that don't really know what it is and what that means in your industry, maybe do that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, to me, it's confusing just because it's tied in. So ESG is environment, social, and governance. It's just an acronym for those terms, but it's tied into the carbon credit type frameworks and whatnot. And that's what these banks, like from the, that's what our state ag commissioners were calling out in these domestic American banks, was in part that, the ESG, because they were involved in the Net Zero Banking Alliance. And whether it's the ESG or what they're doing for the natural asset companies and all those things, it just creates a mechanism to put, in this case, nature on the balance sheet. Because that's what they're ultimately doing here, is that's where they get these ecosystem services, values, and everything else. So they want to monetize nature when it comes down to it. So the whole ESG framework is connected to the efforts that are taking place in Security and Exchange Commission and elsewhere at the government level. And this is where this fascist framework develops, because it's the banking institutions that are pushing the ESG frameworks within banking policy and finance policy in the international realm of things. And then you have domestic agencies in the executive branch that are promulgating and bringing forward mechanisms of regulation and policy that allows for tapping into those international finance markets based on not producing, like cutting a tree down and making lumber and marketing that to your community so they can build a house with it or whatever. No, it's there's a ridge there, there's trees on it. Let's place an arbitrary value on that and allow people to lease or permit or lease that as a non-use, and then market that into the international finance realm as a carbon credit to offset some multinational companies' emissions. So that's not the best definition of ESG per se, but I wanted to just say that, because the ESG framework ties together with a whole bunch of other moving parts, and it's not good. What is good, these state ag commissioners, just really quick, I'll read this one little part from and what they put in this letter they issued to these banks calling out this Net Zero Banking Alliance. They say, due to the potential impacts to agriculture, we are seeking more information regarding what appears to be troubling environmental commitments by your banks that target our farmers, ranchers, and agricultural producers with grave consequences for consumers and that undermine the security of our food supply. And they talk about how these policies want to cut the meat industry, basically, meat consumption in half by 2050. That's what they're,
and
this
what,
alliance
and what better way to
is pushing for.
What better way to do that than make it unaffordable?
Well, they've done that in California. I don't know what eggs cost in your state, but they're hitting $5 a dozen now. But we have happy chickens because they're cage free, and I don't know how they think regulations like that aren't going to impact the end user, because they don't care. No, they don't care.
Yeah.
And yet they'll, when the impacts do hit, and people, are at the grocery store paying $5, they don't understand why. They think maybe the chicken guys are getting fat. That's not it.
You cut back on domestic fuel production too. So then you raise the cost on trucking.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's hitting it at every
turn.
And you got Barbara Lee. Let's not give her a pass here. She wants minimum wage to be $50 an hour.
Yeah, that won't.
So that won't affect the price of food.
No.
I mean, can you imagine? Every farmer's got to pay every single person who does everything on their farm $50 an hour or more.
That shouldn't have too much of an impact on the cost of things. It'll just put people out of business.
We'd have to just get fat on word salad. That's it.
There you are.
We would just have to be bloated on word salad. We could listen to bureaucrats talk all day and just feel full. Or maybe that's just me. Maybe that's what I do for fun. I did that the other day. I had to go to this big long thing on the Klamath. And yeah, at the end I thought, man, if word salad had calories, dang, none of us would be able to get out of the room. Be unbelievable. This isn't a new all this stuff that we're talking about isn't new. I mean, none of these things are new, but
no. But what's new is what this ESG thing. You know, I don't know if people realize this, but farms operate on borrowed money. Ranchers operate on borrowed money. But when they go to a bank, and the bank says, "Oh, you're not falling in line with our environmental guidelines. You need to do X, Y, Z before we can give you a loan." This is all relatively new, and a lot of these, even corporate farms, aren't prepared to make the kind of changes these banks are requiring them to make. So what happens? You either go out of business or
your product is unaffordable.
Exactly.
How much of that is hitting in your industry, Nathan? Is it just across the board, or are there some industries getting hit more right now than others?
Well, I guess what do you mean by hit precisely?
Well,
just with inflation or impacts on profitability, or
back in the late 70s, you know, they basically came at timber. You know, timber was in the crosshairs. And so, you know, the spotted owl had to go through the whole spotted owl thing and crush that industry. Here, anyway, they came after mining. So they claimed mining put mercury in the river, which is a bizarre fiction. But then they came after mining. So they've kind of like picked these off one by one.
So in that context, with the the cattle industry, and I will say, there's a lot of land aggregated in agricultural production. Farm and ranches make up a significant amount of private land ownership throughout the country. So it's important that remains as such, because it's the disaggregated ownership of lands and in the hands of literally hundreds of thousands of people that are functioning somewhat independently on the market. But that's where, so the problem is where the pigeonhole, there's already a bottleneck in the beef supply industry already, because there's already a very centralized beef packing system with four main packers pretty conglomerated and controlling a lot of the packing industry. So there's already a centralization there. It's like a wine glass. You know, you have the base of the wine glass in on the table. That's your producers. That's the ranchers, farmers, or whatever out on the ground. And then there's this little tiny bottleneck that goes through the packing industry, and then the top is the consumers. And
that's the way a lot of the beef supply chain
already is, and it's going to get worse with these trajectories they're pushing.
Of course. We're going to come back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that, because I hear a lot of
158.
A lot of chit-chat about how the
producers
are controlling the cost of the beef. But I guess I'm kind of curious what your take is on how did the price of beef get so high? I mean, you go in right now and try to buy a steak in the grocery store, it's $20. It never used to be that high. So I'm kind of curious what's...
In 20 seconds or less, Nathan, can you explain the entire trajectory of the beef pricing structure?
Well, no, when we come back, we can talk about what's happening there and why just in the last few years has it gotten... I mean, a lot of beef producers sold all their cows and are out. They're not making the money.
Yeah.
It's not the guys raising the cows.
Gosh, you squeeze the producers and it costs more, huh?
Yeah.
What a clever idea. All right, we'll pick that up on the other side. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things, you won't see it coming. What you said, I've been thinking of doing bad things to you.